Does your employer offer to match donations to nonprofit organizations? If so, before your next donation to WORT, please obtain a matching gift form from your employer and include it with your donation. As a 501c3 organization, WORT qualifies for matching gifts from employers. WORT
Community. Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. The judge in Donald Trump's hush money trial in New York has warned him that he'll face time in jail if he keeps violating a gagging order. The former US president was fined $9,000 for contempt of court. That was for 9 violations of the order, barring him from making public statements about witnesses and jurors. Editor Taufik reports.
The judge presiding over Donald Trump's criminal trial found the former president willfully violated his gag order 9 out of the 10 times brought up by prosecutors. Judge Juan Merchan rejected the defense argument that Trump's social media and campaign website posts were merely responding to political attacks. Mr. Trump will have to pay the fines by Friday and has been ordered to remove the offending posts by this afternoon. The judge noted a maximum $1,000 fine per penalty allowed under the law may not dissuade the wealthy presidential candidate from continued violations. He said jail may be a necessary punishment.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country will carry out an offensive against Hamas in the Gaza city of Rafah, regardless of whether or not there's a ceasefire and hostage deal. He was speaking ahead of a meeting of his cabinet.
We will enter Rafah because we have no other choice. We will destroy the Hamas battalions there. We will complete all the objectives of the war, including the repatriation of all our abductees.
A BBC correspondent says Mr. Netanyahu appears to be aligning himself with far-right ministers who want to prioritise an offensive in Rafah. Hamas has still not given its response to the latest ceasefire proposals hammered out during talks in Cairo. An international arrest warrant has been issued for the exiled former president of the Central African Republic, François Bozize, in connection with alleged crimes against humanity. A special UN-sponsored court in the capital, Bangui, said the warrant was for atrocities committed by military personnel between 2009 and 2013. Will Ross reports.
The Central African and foreign judges at the court in the capital Bangui say there's evidence that François Bozize is criminally responsible for atrocities committed by soldiers under his command. Members of the Presidential Guard and other security forces are accused of murder, forced disappearances, torture and rape. The former president will only face trial if the authorities in Guinea-Bissau, where he's in exile, agree to hand him over. In late 2020, Mr. Bozize tried to seize power again, but the rebel group he still heads was pushed back from the capital after Russia sent in hundreds of paramilitaries from the Wagner group.
A Finnish cybercriminal has been jailed for 6 years for trying to blackmail people by threatening to reveal their personal information. Julius Kivimäki hacked into the database of a company offering psychotherapy and stole records of more than 30,000 clients. BBC News. Haiti's newly installed transitional council has appointed the former Senate leader Edgar Leblanc Fils as its president. He'll lead the body which was sworn in last week to restore order in the country, which has been gripped by deadly gang violence. Fritz Belizaire has been named the new prime minister. The post was vacated last month when gangs blocked the return of Ariel Henry to Haiti. Kenya's president has said anyone living in areas at risk of flooding or landslides must move to a safer place. William Ruto was speaking in Mai Mahiu, where at least 45 people have died after a dam overflowed following torrential rain.
The forecast is that rain is going to continue and the likelihood of flooding and people losing lives is real. The military has been mobilized. National Youth Service has been mobilized. All security agencies have been mobilized to assist citizens in such areas to evacuate, to avoid any dangers of loss of life or fatalities.
Across Kenya, more than 160 people have died in recent weeks as a result of floods. The lower house of Congress in Argentina has given its general approval to comprehensive austerity measures proposed by President Javier Milei when he took office in December. The house is now voting on individual articles of the economic package, which has led to huge protests. The legislation, with more than 200 articles, includes tax and labour market reforms and allows the privatisation of several companies. One of France's most prestigious universities has had some of its funding cut because of a pro-Palestinian protest on campus. The authorities at the Paris-based Sciences Po had already called in police to clear one demonstration. Now the regional government has suspended its contribution to the university until it said order had been restored. BBC News.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for two open participating member seats and one open listener sponsor seat to serve three-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war.
Good afternoon, Madison. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. This is A Public Affair. Today, we're spending an hour talking about wealth and income disparities with folks who are working on a solution. That solution, putting cash in the hands of people who need it. Blake Roberts-Krall is a program manager for Madison Forward Fund. The Madison Forward Fund is a grantee in guaranteed income program that gives a monthly, no-strings-attached payment to households for 1 year. How's it going, Blake? How are you doing today?
I'm so good. Really wonderful to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited to talk about what you do and to have you on the show. And you're kind of really where I got into this conversation. So thanks for hanging out with me at Cargo Coffee and letting me know a little bit about how this is working in Madison. We also have on the air today Catherine Kagat, and she is the Research and Program Officer, Mayors for Guaranteed Income. MGI is a network of mayors advocating for a guaranteed income to ensure that all Americans have an income floor. How are you doing today? I hope I said your name, Catherine. I hope I said your last name right, but if I didn't, please correct me.
Hi, Ali. I'm good. It's nice to be here. And yes, you did say it right, so thank you for that.
And then we also have Gina, ooh, this is going to be the one that I don't pull off. Slipped?
Stilp, you're close.
Okay. Is the executive director of Ziebler Family Foundation. The foundation is a private independent grant-making institution. They are now accepting application for Milwaukee's first unconditional cash program. You all are doing really exciting work. I want to talk a little bit. We've talked on this show about universal basic income before. And so when I first sat down with you, Blake, I kind of thought, oh, this is along the lines of universal basic income. And you kind of schooled me on some of the differences and how these programs are coming to life in real time. For folks who don't know what guaranteed income is, who it serves, how it's come about. What should folks know? And Gina, I'm going to start off with you.
Well, thank you for having me. I will admit readily that I'm the newbie on this call. Catherine and Blake have been in the field and doing this work for longer than I, and so I've learned a lot from them. But we really look at guaranteed income, universal basic income, or direct cash transfers, all in a big bucket of opportunity to provide no strings attached cash to families at its kind of highest level. And so the way that the Ziebler Family Foundation is rolling out a program in Milwaukee called the Bridge Project, we are we are using the terms cash transfers because we are delivering cash assistance over a two-year period with all private dollars. And so we're completely funded by private philanthropy, which I think is also a differentiator in some of these conversations around UBI, guaranteed income, or cash transfer work.
When you say something like, you know, there's an unconditional, Milwaukee's first unconditional cash program, that makes it sound like anybody has access to these resources. Like, you can be a millionaire, you can be homeless, there's no difference. If you want money, we're going to give it to you. Kat, can you talk a little bit about what the unconditional cash program really is in Milwaukee and who really has access to it?
Do you want me to jump in here? So I think in Milwaukee, Ali, it's while it is the use of the cash is unconditional, we do have some conditions on who can qualify for the program. And because we're starting out with 100 individuals who are eligible, we did feel that putting some parameters around qualifications was important so that we're meeting a high need population in Milwaukee. So we're particularly focused on pregnant individuals who are earning less than $39,000 per year. They are living in particular neighborhoods in Milwaukee, which are neighborhoods where the Zilber Family Foundation has been investing in quality of life improvements for the past 15 years, and neighborhoods where we know there is a high prevalence of poverty. And then third, the Bridge Project that we're rolling out is very focused on empowering women and young children to thrive in the first 1,000 days of their lives. And so another qualification is that pregnant individuals are 23 weeks pregnant or less. And the rationale there is that we would be able to provide a prenatal stipend to pregnant moms, pregnant individuals, and make sure that they're being connected to resources that will help baby thrive in the first 1,000 days of life.
That is really, really interesting. I think when you get down to kind of pregnancy as a qualifier, I think that that's a really specific group of people. And then when you get even more into like how pregnant you can be to get in that, it really kind of narrows things. I'm curious because people experiencing pregnancy exist at a range of points in life. So, you know, you can be pregnant at the age of 8, you know. How does kind of age factor into the pregnancy qualification? Are you all supporting teenage parents?
So we do have another requirement. We're looking for pregnant individuals who are 18 years or older. And so we're really looking at an opportunity to provide some stability in the life of a young mother, but perhaps a mother who is on her own, who's out of the house, who is really about to start her adult life. And so what we have seen already is in the application sort of uptake is that these are young women who are seeking not only the opportunity to have this cash assistance, but who are very open to building the social network and social cohesion to potentially connecting with one another to create some kind of community around this opportunity. And while that is by no means a requirement of the program, I think that the desire there, not only from the applicants, but from the nonprofit community in Milwaukee who's providing services for moms and babies, is a really great opportunity for us to even, you know, magnify the impact of the cash transfer.
Thank you so much for speaking to that. I think that's really exciting to learn about, and I'm so excited to learn more. And if you're out there and you have questions about this pilot or about guaranteed basic income across the nation or in Madison and Milwaukee specifically, the number is 608-256-2001. Huge shout out to our receptionist, Steve. Steve, you're the best week after week here picking up the phone for us. Last week, stayed a little late to make sure that I could connect a caller with a resource. So huge shout out to Steve. Our engineer, John, could not do the show without you, John. Love working with you. So sad that I am moving to Wednesday next week. And although that'll be really nice for me and my personal rest, I'm going to miss working with John because he's the best engineer you could have. He's a great person to like bounce ideas off of and also just like make sure that this we're on the air. We're live on the air. It doesn't happen without him. And then, of course, Jade. Jade has been sick for the last 5 days. She is the best producer ever. And, you know, shout out to her for being here and masked and still making it all happen and, like, you know, bringing an exuberant joy to the work that we do while not feeling great. So if you want to call and say, get better, Jade, I encourage you to do that too. The number is 608-256-2001. We're talking about guaranteed income today. And I want to ask you, Blake, what this means in Madison. So Madison had a pilot guaranteed program last year. You all are going into another version of this program this year. Talk a little bit about what you've learned from the work you've already done and what you hope to achieve with the work you're doing now.
Yeah, and just to add to what Gina said, you know, we're so excited that the program in Milwaukee is launching right now. And I think Gina described, you know, that specific version of what a guaranteed income program can look like, that it's targeted towards low-income pregnant people. And Madison's is a little bit different, and there's a lot of other similar pilot programs that are happening across the country. Each one is a little bit different, has their own unique sort of flavor or target population, frequency, duration, all these things. But a lot of them, I think, have maybe some core common characteristics. So I can talk about that and then talk about how it plays out in Madison. So as Gina said, you know, these are payments that are given directly to recipients, not to a third party. And the payments are flexible or unrestricted. So people can spend it however they need, with the idea that people know best, right, how to efficiently meet their family's needs. And it's unconditional. I think of that all, you know, yes, all, what Gina said, but also of it's not an exchange for something. We're not asking people to perform work or labor. We're not asking people to participate in a class or a training program. It's they are able to receive the money because they meet the eligibility criteria, and that's it. And then it's also, for at least when we were thinking about the Madison program, really intended to supplement other social safety net programs that already exist. We're not trying to replace anything. The social safety net is incredibly important. We need it, and we're not doing enough. People are still being left behind.
Blake, I want to ask a question about that, because I think that's actually a really complicated part of this work. If you don't want to undermine other social safety nets, a lot of times if you want to access something like food stamps, or if you want to access something like, you know, subsidized housing, or if you're getting a disability check, right, your income really matters to your ability to qualify for those benefits. Is some of what you're doing just inherently going to push people off of other social safety nets because people have to report this income and it may push them beyond the amount that they're allowed to have? While they receive certain benefits, things like Badger Care health insurance, things like food share, things like subsidized housing, things like a disability check?
I love that question because I love getting really in the weeds of social safety net policy, regulation, and enforcement. But it's complicated. And yes, every program has different rules about who can qualify and what income you can have and what types of income you can have. So you're absolutely right. If someone starts receiving an additional $500 a month, in some cases that could mean that they are over the income limit for other public assistance programs. So thinking about how to prevent that cliff, it's like a benefits cliff, we call it, where you could actually lose benefits and be net loss in the end, is a huge part of what many programs do before they launch, to make sure that there's a plan in place to prevent or at least minimize that type of interaction. Because the last thing we want to do is just move money from one program to the other, or even cause more harm by having people lose benefits, especially things like Section 8 or SSI, where once you lose that benefit, it is so, so hard to get it back.
Thank you so much for speaking to kind of the intricacies of how these things work together. I often think people underestimate the complexity of what it means to survive while living in poverty. And as a person who grew up in poverty, I'm like, you have to be pretty calculated to navigate those systems well for your family. I want to bring a caller on the air. I want to welcome David to the show. David, I think you have a clarifying question about language. How are you doing today?
Hey, we're pretty good, and I'm glad I followed that previous question. Mine had to do with the valuations that are being set. You know, when you're talking about in the previous caller, whether it was, say, for an additional $500 a month, which may or may not be the real number. When you start thinking about the way that the inflation has jacked things up from just 5 years ago, the aid for families with dependent children or the food stamps amount, all of these different numbers are way low already. And if they've got a cap that is still below the poverty line, that becomes dangerous. And I'm glad there was discussion about the first 1,000 days of a child's life. If a kid gets malnourished in those first 1,000 days, they can have, you know, all sorts of problems in later life, whether it's health problems or cognitive problems, attention, all sorts of different things. So it's very important that we, the people, invest in our neighbors. So the real question I'm leading up to is there a valuation level that is set at a real level as opposed to an artificially stingy level? And looking at this as an election year, the right-wing stations are just laughing about when the stock market goes bad, they're going to say, oh, Donald Trump will win because the economy is crashing. But aid, helping these little kids in the first 1,000 days of their lives is going to save America a huge amount of money because the investment in those first 1,000 days is going to make their lives better, health-wise, and the kids won't end up in a further spiral of additional costs.
Thank you so much for your question, David. I really appreciate that you factored in inflation. And I think part of what you're asking is how much money is enough money to live on right now? I think a lot of what we're seeing is that the subsidies we've created for people kind of no longer are cutting it in terms of giving people access to quality of life and basic dignity. Kat, you are talking about this from a governance standpoint, from, mayors across the country. How much money do people need to live in a major metropolitan area in the United States of America right now? And I'm sorry, Catherine.
No worries, Kat's fine too. That's sort of the big question that all these jurisdictions are asking. And I will say that at the moment, because it is, counties and cities doing it, and in the case of California, the state, they are restricted to, of course, a budget, right? So there's a calculus happening of how much can we afford and how many people can we serve. And so right now, that $500 kind of standard, some go beyond 500, some go 1,000, some go a little bit below, but that $500 standard is more so because there was a Federal Reserve study that said, most Americans can't afford a $400 emergency. So the $500 kind of, it's not artificial necessarily, but this number that we're working with at the moment, or kind of a foundational number, let's say, is based off the idea that if you take away that emergency, then there might be, people might be in a better position to then have some stability. The other thing I will say is, we did have a guaranteed income done by the federal government by the name of the Expanded Child Tax Credit, which was $300 per child per household, and I think the cutoff was like $200,000 if you're making $200,000 a year. And even that, the $300, that had like tremendous impact. It cut child poverty by half, right? And when it expired in 2021, December 2021, it then shot up poverty. So we see that even just $300 a month per child is already so impactful. So if we go even beyond that and we counter in cost of living, right? Because California is probably going to be more expensive than a certain state. New York City is probably going to be more expensive than a certain city. So if we factor those in, then I think we can have a number that better serves people. But at the very least, we saw what $300 can do. So that's a great starting point even.
I'm so curious about how this factors into wages, right? Like if you're offering these benefits to folks who are making minimum wage has been the same since I was a teenager working at KFC. And that was 20 years ago. I'm a middle-aged lady with three kids at this point. So, you know, how do we compensate, I think, to get back to our caller's question, for this climate, for kind of stagnant wages for people who are chronically underemployed and under compensated for their labor, and the rate of inflation. And I very much appreciate kind of the $500 a month being driven from the idea that the average American can't, you know, lives paycheck to paycheck and can't really withstand a $400 car repair. Talk to me about the how meeting the needs of folks informs this work.
I think I'll just jump in. This is Gina in Milwaukee. Our initial payment for mom is about $1,200 in a prenatal stipend. And then the first 15 months, she'll receive $750. And then on the back end, as the program winds down, it'll be $375 a month. And we really looked at cost of living in Milwaukee and what it takes for, you know, a person who is earning less than $39,000 a year to have just what you said, Ali, is that little extra to make sure that there's food on the table, that the rent is paid, that the electric bill is current, and that there might be opportunity for childcare. And I think that's a big issue. We all know, those of us who are moms to young children, that can be, you know, a significant portion of your income on a monthly basis. And so what we hope is that in a lot of ways, this is an economic driver as much as it is a stability or a safety net. If we can offer the opportunity for families to go to work because they can actually afford to fix their car or have a stable house or make sure that when their kids are sick, they could take a day off work and still have a little extra in their pocket. That actually enables a better workforce, a healthier workforce, and a more stable family. And so I think, you know, while this is sometimes a political issue, I think it's really important to look at it from both sides, which is, yes, it's a safety net, but it's also allowing people to have the autonomy and the dignity to participate in our economy. And that's a really important part of this.
Gina, I want to talk to you specifically about this kind of parenting aspect of this, in part because Catherine brought up the child tax credit. You know, when I think about, I have three children. I have two children who have a little bit of child care. One kid has wraparound care after school. One kid goes to, you know, she's a toddler. She goes to daycare. That's about $1,800 a month. And that's a pretty reasonable rate. So, you know, just factoring in what it costs to put a kid in daycare, let alone an infant in daycare, which is what your program is talking about. How do you all factor in things like maternity leave? Are these folks who are, you know, 23 weeks pregnant or less, expected to go back to work immediately? In the United States, the average Black woman gives birth at the age of 19 and goes back to work 2 weeks later. How do you all accommodate, you know, availability for parenting and supporting somebody in that first 1,000 days of their kid's life? What are the expectations?
You know, I think this is such an important part of this. And what you're hitting on to me, Ali, is that this is not just an issue that cash transfers will solve. We have serious policy challenges in our country that don't support moms and don't support babies. And so I think what this offers us the opportunity to do is to celebrate that we're able to put this cash in the pockets of families that need it, and then also lift up these other policy and advocacy opportunities that we have. And I think that's why it's so vital that we have folks like Catherine and Blake, who we're all doing this from a little bit of a different platform. You know, Zilber Family Foundation as a private funder, we have Catherine's expertise on using public dollars, we have Blake, who's sort of a hybrid, and we can all talk about how we're advancing this economic prosperity for families and saying, but there's a lot more work to do to make sure that there is a safety net and that families are taken care of.
Thank you so much for speaking to that. I think when you think about social safety nets, oftentimes I think the American frame is, you know, if you give people resources, if you give people healthcare, if you give people cash, if you give people housing, then what is the motivation to get a job? What is the motivation to be independent and take responsibility? Why should I have to pay for somebody else's kid to go to daycare or for somebody else's food? Why should we be responsible for that collectively? I want to ask you, Blake, why do you think Americans are reluctant to invest in one another via social safety net? Why do you think there's this kind of resentment and contempt towards people living in poverty? And do you think that this work enables people to not, you know, invest in themselves in the ways that would allow for them to be independent?
Oh, I think about this all the time because it comes up in how we design and run this pilot and then other programs too. So I think that one of the things that I love about cash assistance policies like guaranteed income is that it can reframe the narratives that we have or be a tool to help reframe it. And some of the core values, I think, driving program design of the social safety net for guaranteed income is that we know people are working hard, people are working their butts off, and that there's lots of different types of labor and work in a community. That could be formal paid employment, it could be informal, it could be care work, taking care of children, family members, it could be volunteering. And traditionally, we have tied worthiness or who is deserving to who earns a paycheck. And I really want to think about how to decouple those two things, because you are worthy of support whether you have a paycheck, no matter what type of work you are doing, because we all work in different ways and we are all human. So really trying to use this program as an opportunity to think about that narrative change work. And doing really fun storytelling work around kind of elevating that need that you're talking about, Ali, of like, how do we imagine a social safety net or a system that works for everybody and that is equitable and that we believe in, right? That it's not, we don't want people to have resentment if we're supporting folks, right? That's not the message that we want to be sending.
I think though that, you know, going back to something that Catherine said, and Catherine, I see that you've got your hand up, and I just want to remind folks, you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. This is a public affair. It is Tuesday, but next week, if you want to tune in to hear me, you have to tune in on Wednesday because I'm switching back to my old time, and hopefully you'll follow me to that day of the week. That being said, I want to ask you, Catherine, kind of, you know, you use that number. The average American cannot afford a $400 car repair, which means most people need this kind of help. Like the average person needs this kind of help. But what you all are describing isn't making these resources available to the average person. You're talking about making these resources available to people who live in specifically desperate kinds of poverty. And so if everybody needs it, but only some people are getting it, how do you reconcile that dynamic in our country right now? How do you have that conversation with people when they go, hey, I would really benefit from this too. My kids really need that as well. Why are they getting it and I'm not?
Yeah, and just to know, I think the thing that we're finding out with you know, the pandemic and the stimulus check and the child tax credit and with the guaranteed income pilots is that there is no kind of one face of poverty, and that actually, like, you don't have to be in dire straits to not be able to afford an emergency, that actually so many of us, because so many Americans can't afford a $400 emergency, it means that, like, we are just one paycheck away from being in dire straits, that you could be middle class and be kind of a paycheck or two away from poverty. And I think part of the framework of guaranteed income. It's not necessarily that only a small portion of the community would get it, or only a small portion of the population would get it, but essentially that communities that are most impacted by poverty are also then get an outsized benefit from guaranteed income, but also that people get an income floor. That means that, like, if you're a billionaire, you don't need an income floor, right? But it could also be in the form of, like, the child tax credit that any family under a certain threshold, which again, in CTC, it was $200,000, that they would have that income floor for their child. And maybe that goes up until you're 18. But there are so many ways that you can craft a policy where people are getting an income floor, but that a wide, broad set of the American population are getting it, and not necessarily this kind of thinking of just, you know, a small portion. I will also say, like, you know, high tide raises all boats, right? So the more people that are doing well, the more our communities will do well as well. So
I hear that, and I deeply respect that messaging. And yet I think there is this emotional reaction to, you know, how hard people work and what you should get based on the kind of job you have, the kind of work you do. I think that's deeply ingrained in people. I think a lot of people think of the income floor as minimum wage. That's our way of saying, hey, at the bare minimum, you work full time, you will make this amount. It is illegal to compensate you with less than that. Talk about kind of separating income from labor, from a job. And I really appreciate it. I heard you say, Gina, everybody's working. I think the fact that you all are targeting moms, who are some of, like, the hardest working people ever, is really powerful. And at the same time, we're a society that recognizes labor in a specific kind of way. And so if you're at home taking amazing care of your toddler and your infant, we as a society think, well, that's a luxury. Good for you. But I have to get up, take my kids to daycare and go to work if I want to be able to pay my bills. And I think you should have to do the same thing. Gina, talk to me a little bit about how you kind of get people to think about income that is not connected to a job.
Well, I think there is sort of a misunderstanding in America by most people about how much government intervention we all benefit from. And there's a clear narrative that if you're poor, you get a government subsidy, and that's the way that our system works and our social safety net works. But in reality, it's people who are higher income earners who actually receive greater government subsidy in the form of tax benefit.
Gina, and I just want you to just, like, repeat that just one more time for the folks in the back. What did you just say?
Yeah, I mean, wealthy individuals, families earning, you know, over the poverty line. So if you make over $40,000 a year and you own a house, you're much more likely to have more government subsidy than somebody who is poor. And that comes, it's a hidden way, right? We're not getting a food SNAP benefit card, but we are getting a mortgage interest deduction on our taxes, or we are getting money that goes into our retirement savings that's tax-free. And so when you are wealthy, or if you have that extra income, you have more available to you to preserve it and to pass it forward. And so I think it is so unfair that we have created this sort of siloed understanding of who receives the benefits that our government doles out. We all do. And so just because I don't need mine in a form of housing assistance doesn't mean that I'm not benefiting from it on my taxes, right? And so I think that, you know, just facts are helpful in this discussion, and to understand where we spend money in our country. We spend far more money on interest, mortgage interest deductions than we do on HUD for rent assistance programs. And so, you know, one is just understanding what we're doing and why we're doing it. I think two is very clearly in some of the research that has been done on guaranteed income or cash transfer programs, there's actually an increase in employment. People want to work, you know, people do want to work. And so having additional cash assistance without strings attached allows families to make the decisions that they need to make for their family. It might not look the same for yours or for mine. our childcare situations are different, our transportation situations, our work, you know, we all have a unique experience. And so having the flexibility to navigate our own expenses is shouldn't necessarily be a luxury.
Thank you so much for speaking to that. I want to remind folks, if you are interested in joining this conversation, the number is 608-256-2001. We would love to hear your questions, especially if you have questions about how to get involved in this, how to support it, how to learn more about it. If you want to be a person who, you know, participates in this program here in Madison, let's talk to you a little bit, Blake, about that. Blake, Where are you at in terms of kind of the next iteration of guaranteed, you know, guaranteed income in Madison?
Yeah, so Madison launched our first guaranteed income program in 2022. And it really got started under the leadership of Mayor Rhodes Conway, who saw this as an opportunity to really be contributing to research, right? So around social policy, an opportunity to test what happens on the ground in our community when you give poor folks money, and to do it in a Madison-specific context. And then to be contributing to the national research that's happening, because there are many, many other communities that are running similar experiments, which is really exciting to get to be part of that network. So that's when how the program originally got started. And it ran for 12 months. So there were 155 families, low-income families from Madison, that were selected to receive monthly cash payments. And then the last payment was issued in August of last year. So we finished that first research study, which is really exciting. And we have some fantastic research partners here at UW and at University of Pennsylvania who are now crunching away at numbers and looking at sort of ultimate findings, which I'm excited to be able to share, you know, later this year, probably, or next year. But in the meantime, you know, we're here, there's a lot of data from other places that we can pull from to see the potential impact of cash transfer programs. And then we're also able to talk to people sort of anecdotally who were part of that first round, to hear from them in their own words, what impact it's had. So we know that this is going to be an important policy that we want to keep going. And as you mentioned, Ali, we're now in the planning stages of figuring out a second iteration, which is really exciting. I think a lot of the details are still to be worked out, because it does take some time to kind of plan and figure out how to fund it and everything. But I'm hoping that that program, second round, can happen this year is the goal.
Blake, I'm going to ask you and Catherine this question, and I would love to hear from Catherine first and then bounce back over to you, Blair. How much research is enough research to know that this works, that it's good for people, that we should embrace it, that it is something that we as a society can afford and is hugely beneficial to people? I just want to remind folks who are listening that the state of Wisconsin spends more on incarceration than anything else. That's what we spend the most on as a state. So we have the money for that, and a lot of money for that. How much research needs to go into this and it working well? A lot of research has said that incarceration is ineffective, that it does not produce a safer society, that in fact, it can produce just the opposite. So we have all this research saying, hey, what we spend the most money on doesn't work super well. It doesn't produce great results. How much research do we need saying that this works well for people, that it produces good results, that it increases, you know, people's interest in work, that it allows for people to live, you know, greater quality lives, that it is better for our children? How many times do you all have to say that, research that, find that out before we go, we've got the research we need, let's do it? Catherine, I'm going to ask you first.
Yeah, I wish we could already say that because in the research that we have seen from different jurisdictions, we have seen sort of the same things, right? So it has improved housing quality. As Gina mentioned, it didn't negatively impact work. It actually increased full-time employment. Sometimes it increases self-employment even. And then we had a large, again, nationwide guaranteed income in the child tax credit, and reports from that were largely positive. So we wish we could say there was enough. But I will say, maybe not so much say how much research is needed, but ask ourselves, why are we not believing the data? And I think a lot of that has to do with some of the things that we've mentioned on this call, which is the narrative, right? That we have this kind of deep-seated misconceptions. Gina mentioned some of them. We don't call benefits that go to rich people benefits because we don't attach those stigma, but they do get benefits. And so I think that's what we have to work on, because if we have the data and it's clear data, and we don't just have them now, I mean, we've had guaranteed income or some sort of guaranteed income or cash, direct cash transfer pilots in the past, and they pretty much said the same thing, that it improves people's lives when they have money, which seems like a no-brainer. but it's really the narrative work that we have to dig deeper in and ask ourselves these questions. We have the research, why are we not believing it? And why are we continuing these narratives?
Well, doesn't it then become an issue of preference? Like, Blake, I want to ask you this question. Is it a matter of what we prefer to do with people who live in poverty? Is it that we can't afford to give people who live in poverty a wage floor? Is it that we cannot afford to make sure everybody has health care and quality education? Or is it that we prefer that some people don't have as much opportunity as others? Is that kind of the preference that we have as a society? We would rather pay to incarcerate somebody who is homeless than pay less for that same person to have housing. Blake, where does preference factor in, and how do you accommodate preference within the context of your research?
I think poverty is a policy choice. Yes, we can always be researching more, and there are some specific areas that we can be digging into if we want to know what the right amount of money is to give people, what format to give it in, for how long. Sure, we can always be digging into that. But generally, we know that people need money to move out of poverty. And I think we have a lot of different policy ideas for how to do that. So it absolutely is a choice. And one area that I think would be really helpful is to have some numbers around the cost benefit analysis that you're talking about, right? So how much money could we save by preventing or reducing incarceration? How much money could we save in the long run by preventing evictions, by preventing family separations, all these things that we know are drivers in poverty and financial scarcity? So I think that's one piece of evidence or data, I guess, that could help potentially get change that choice that people are making of, like, can we make a financial comparison to help see the long-term benefits? I think that that could be really, could be beneficial.
One of the things that I think has dictated a lot of social safety nets is the idea that people living in poverty are not capable of making good financial decisions for themselves, that they are not capable of, you know, picking the food that is going to get them the most bang for their buck, that they are not capable of distributing their resources towards their housing themselves. And I think there is some reality to the idea that if you give somebody who's making $80,000 a $300 tax credit, that they might use it to put their kid in ballet or piano. And if you give that same amount to somebody who's making $21,000 a year, that they might be using it for their most basic necessities. When you talk about how people use these resources, which is, I think, an area where people would get really critical, and they're like, oh, this person is, you know, taking it to the casino, or this person is, you know, having a really nice night out at the bar with some girlfriends and treating everybody. I think people might get a little judgmental about how people use these resources. What has your research shown about how people use this money? And Blake, I'll start with you.
Yeah, we have data from our first pilot to show how people are spending their money. Far and away, the main thing people are spending the vast majority of their money on is basic daily needs. So food, clothing, housing and utilities, and transportation. So that's the vast majority. And we have a really great dashboard where you can see numbers to show that, because I do think, I get
ask that question a lot. People want to, we have a lot of concerns and worries about how people are spending their money. So I think the data show it's really not like quote unquote lavish things, but I also would say everyone deserves to do something special for themselves every now and then. You know, whether you're rich or poor, that's something that I believe we can do in our society. And I also would maybe ask another question in response of like, why do we have so much worry or mistrust about how people spend their money when we don't have that same level of scrutiny for wealthier folks?
I mean, I think that this is part of what makes the conversation so interesting, right? Is that there is our presumptions around people who live in poverty. And then there are also the assumptions we make about people who are wealthy, right? People who are wealthy have earned their money. People who are wealthy have the right to enjoy their success. I think that there's a need to interrogate the way we think about wealthy people right now. And I think that's an exciting opportunity. And hopefully our caller, whose name I want to say right, but I'm not sure I'm going to say right, Lorian, has a comment about a friend who participated in the program. It would be great to have you come on to the show. Thank you so much for joining us today, caller.
Hi. Hello. Good afternoon. Hi, everybody. Can everybody hear me?
We can hear you. We're so grateful that you're joining us. And I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name. You want to tell us who you are and what you want to ask about today?
Yeah, you did it perfect. My name is Lorian Carter, actually. And I am currently a community liaison. I work at the Juvenile Retainment Center. And actually, I do Tuesday Morning Buzz there. So hi, fellow radio host.
Hey, WORT family.
Yes. Hello, WORT family. Well, I was calling because I have a friend and he is a single father who actually was receiving, benefits from the program. And prior to being on the program, it was really a struggle. He had to pick up a lot of extra hours. And I mean, a truly single parent. And his son was actually struggling with reading because he wasn't getting enough time at home. When he started receiving the benefits, he was actually able to cut down some of his work hours. And his son has special needs. So within that year's time, I'm talking about an 80 to 90% improvement in his son's reading. The quality of living that he was able to get from that, from receiving those benefits each month, is really incomparable to anything else. There's a certain level, I think one of the things we don't consider when we talk about dealing with historically disenfranchised communities is we're not talking about self-care and how important it is. I'm also a certified parent peer support specialist. Wisconsin is currently leading the nation in this particular field. And one of the main things that we deal with is making sure that our parents, our peers, have a level of self-care. And when I tell you food insecurity, basic need insecurity are two of the biggest issues facing that community right now. And the relief that they receive, not worrying about if they're going to be able to do small things like buy that pack of toilet paper from the gas station or be able to put gas in their car to go to Walmart to get the better deal. Things that we really don't consider, they were monumental for his life, for his time, and for his children.
Oh, so, I mean, thank you enough for joining us and for everything you just shared with us. I really think that you've kind of set us off for the last few minutes to talk about the benefits of this program, why you all are passionate about this work. You are each going to have about a minute to just talk a little bit about why this work matters to you and what the benefits are, as well as how people can support this work, follow this work, stay engaged. I'm going to start with you, Catherine.
Thanks for that, Allie. And I just kind of want to go back to what Blake was mentioning about joy, right? And being able to thrive. I think so so much so we think of basic needs when we think of like a social safety net. It's just about basic needs and surviving. And I think we can do better than that for everybody. I think we can put people in position to thrive. And part of the way that guaranteed income helps with that is having that income floor in concert with all the other policies that could support economic stability and for people to thrive. You know, a stronger social safety net that trusts people and gives them dignity, living wage rather than a minimum wage. So I think guaranteed income in concert with those policies really puts people in a position where they don't just have to survive, where they can actually aspire and thrive.
Catherine, I will think of you as the ambassador of prosperity for like the rest of my life. I love what you just said. Gina, talk to me a little bit about why you're passionate about this program in Milwaukee, the benefits of it, and how people can follow the work that you're doing.
So one of the core tenets of the Bridge Project is prevent instead of undo. And so we have really attached to that narrative. We are invest now, right? We've already made enough choices in our community and stigmatized poverty. And we know what the outcome is. We see it. It's expensive to care for kids who are struggling to read or who have housing insecurity or where mom and dad are working extra shifts. And so maybe they are unsupervised for a longer period. So we have a choice. This is an investment in not only mom, but an investment in our next generation. And until we have a social safety net or policy changes that would enable this for everybody, the Zilber Family Foundation is really focused on, one, making sure people in Milwaukee understand what this program is, two, making sure that we can connect mothers and children to the abundant social services that we do have in the city. So we're looking for those points of connection. And three, we are welcome and welcoming to any other private funders who want to join us. We want to make this a third-year program, and we want to sustain it so that next year we're bringing another 100 moms and kids into the program.
Oh, that's incredible to hear. Thank you so much for sharing that. Blake, you've got the last word. Why are you passionate about this work? What are the benefits here in Madison? How can folks stay tuned and see what comes next for you all and support this work if they're inspired by it?
For me, I think on the biggest level, it's about care. And because that really resonates with me as an individual, as a community member, as a parent, and how I want to be able to show up to care for my family and how I want to be cared for. And I think because we see like that story from the caller is exactly, it's like a perfect example how having a little bit of extra cash creates a cushion and then opened up so many opportunities for this dad to be able to be the parent that he wants to be, and like how all of us so desperately want to be able to show up for our kids and for our family and our community. But sometimes the system that we built gets in the way. So I really love thinking about guaranteed income as a way to reimagine systems of care and to be valuing all the different types of care work that we do. In Madison, I would love for people to go to our website and just sign up for our newsletter because then you can get updates when we do have exciting things coming. And if you want to learn more or reach out to me directly, our website is madisonforwardfund.wisc.edu. This has been really wonderful. Thank you so much.
I cannot thank you all enough for bringing voice to this, for all of the compassion and love and work that you are doing to inspire our community to take better care of one another. I don't think there's anything better I could talk about on a Tuesday. So thank you all so much for joining us here on WORT 89.9 FM. Huge shout out to our amazing producer, Jade, who is ill. We hope you get better soon, but thank you for holding it down regardless. Also, we love you, John. You've been a great engineer. I will miss you. Tune in next week on Tuesday. I'm not sure who will be here, but it will not be me. If you want to hear me, Ali Muldrow, I will be on the air next week on Wednesday. Thank you so much, everybody who called into the show. I'll see you next week.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The apathetic bull, to send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree. And hell no, you cannot predict.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters and Politics. On today's show,
Jordan Fuchs knows the dangers that Raffensperger would face if he got into a phone call with Trump, and how he could distort what got said in that phone call. And she, on her own, makes this momentous decision to secretly tape the phone call, the hour-long phone call that Trump had with Brad Raffensperger. She didn't tell Raffensperger. She didn't tell Meadows. Of course, she didn't tell Trump.
As the Supreme Court considers Donald Trump's appeal for immunity from federal prosecution over the 2020 election, we'll be joined by two investigative journalists, Michael Isikoff and Daniel Kleidman. They both spent years in Georgia after the election, and they have co-written a book about 2020. It's called Find Me the Votes, A Hard-Charging Georgia Prosecutor, A Rogue President, and the Plot to Steal an American Election. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. The judge in Donald Trump's hush money trial has warned him that he'll keep jail if he keeps violating an order barring him from making public statements about witnesses and jurors. The former US president was fined $9,000 for contempt of court. Here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
Donald Trump has until the end of this week to pay the fine, and he's also been ordered to take down the social media posts which the judge ruled to have been in contempt of court. Comments he had made online about his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, the adult film star Stormy Daniels, and the makeup of the jury pool. The judge has specifically barred Mr. Trump from attacking any potential witnesses in this trial, court staff, jurors, and any of their families. Judge Merchan noted a $9,000 fine isn't a lot to a wealthy defendant such as Donald Trump and may not be much of a deterrent. So he warned that if necessary and appropriate, he will consider sending Mr. Trump to jail. The prosecution have flagged another four comments from Mr. Trump which they believe have breached the order, and there will be a hearing about those on Thursday.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country will carry out an offensive against Hamas in the Gaza city of Rafah, regardless of whether there's a ceasefire and hostage deal. Speaking ahead of